All right. Thanks for being with us. My name is Michael Fisher. I'm a researcher with EAB, and I'm here with Dr. Shane Martin, the provost of Seattle University. Prior to being at Seattle University, Dr. Martin was a member of the faculty at Loyola Marymount University, and in his role as provost of Seattle University, he was one of the first leadership members and members of an institution that was responding to the coronavirus outbreak in early 2020. It's my pleasure to have him here today. Thank you, Dr. Martin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you and to talk to our colleagues across the network.
I know it's been a hectic few days for you on your campus. Tell me about the days leading up to your decision to move your classes online and move to a remote option for learning. When did you start discussing the possibility of having to cancel classes?
So we made the decision and made the announcement a week ago today. So that was March 6th. But we had been certainly talking about that the previous week. On the morning of Friday, March 6th, University of Washington announced that they were moving to virtual learning environment. And we felt that it was important for us to act because we knew that as soon as one institution in our region made that decision, that our community would heighten the anxiety around what was our institution going to be doing. And so we thought that was very important.
What were the major factors beyond looking at other institutions in the area that prompted your decision to move online?
So, you know, at the time, what was emerging very much so was that the Seattle area was being seen as the epicenter of the COVID-19 outbreak in the United States. Certainly, there's been other areas since then that have really popped up as other hot spots. But at the time, the media was portraying that, you know, Seattle was the center of this. And so we had a range of concerns. The first, of course, was the health and safety of our students, our faculty, and our staff, and just thinking about, you know, ways that we could keep everyone safe, which was critically important to us. We were also thinking about a number of other factors, including our reputational capital with the community and with our various communities and stakeholders in terms of what we were doing and in terms of the decisions that we were making. So we were balancing a number of things. Increasingly, our students who tend to be progressive and activist oriented were asking for solutions that would not require them to come to campus. Faculty were asking, what are we going to do? So we had both external and internal pressures to act and to act in a timely manner and decisively. So our initial decision was that, first of all, we're on the quarter system. So our initial decision was that the remainder of the winter quarter, which at that last Friday meant it was 1 week of instruction followed by 1 week of exams and culminating projects, that all of that would move to a virtual learning environment. And we gave a series of options to our faculty and students for how they could complete the winter quarter. We had to put that together, and to be honest, we found ourselves scrambling a little bit because while we had done some preliminary work on that, we had not, you know, thought everything through. But we did that work, got out guidance. It had to send a couple of updates, especially as key questions came up, including it was very important for us to have an FAQ page, to have a dedicated email and phone number that faculty could access with questions and concerns, an additional one for students. A point person for students was really important. A point person for parents was really important. So we had to put all those things together rather quickly and then communicate them. A few days ago, we started looking at the best data we have on What is projected to be the trajectory of COVID-19 in the Seattle area and in the United States. And we are about to announce today that we will move the spring quarter into a virtual learning environment as well. What we're doing there is we're going to rearrange we have a 10-week quarter followed by 1 week of exams and culminating experience, so it's really 11 weeks. And we're going to have the first week be a preparation week where we will not have classes. We will allow give our faculty more time. It's one thing for faculty to have to figure out a plan to end a quarter that has gone through 90% and just have options to how to end that quarter successfully. It's another thing to ask the entire faculty and university to be prepared to go online or a virtual learning environment, many who have never done that before. So we will have we will delay the start of the quarter by 1 week. And that will give an opportunity for everyone to be more fully prepared.
What was the sort of infrastructure and current status of remote instruction on your campus prior to this infectious disease crisis? Did you already offer many online classes? Were there faculty members with experience with online instruction?
So my view of where we were prior to this, I would put us in the middle of the pack, maybe slightly below the middle of the pack in terms of other higher ed institutions. We were about average. We certainly were not a leader in distance and virtual learning in any way. And so it did push us. However, where we were advantaged is we have a very strong Center for Digital Learning and Innovation. We have a very strong center for faculty development, and both of those entities have been able to add a lot of support and professional development for our faculty. In particular, our Center for Digital Learning and Innovation was able to ramp up, to scale up very quickly, professional development support, both initially face-to-face and then online for faculty, with the kind of support and guidance on how to move your class into a virtual environment in a way that still provides deep academic quality. There were some challenges there, especially in particular disciplines that have labs or in performing arts, in those kinds of disciplines. Certainly in some of our professional schools like nursing, education, law, that have clinical experiences, fieldwork experiences, externships that are tied to courses, that the successful completion of those is required for completing the class. Where we've had to look at a whole range of innovative ways to think about how we're handling that. Of course, we're helped by the recent guidance from the Department of Education, which at a high level is allowing institutions to have flexibility on some of these requirements.
You mentioned that in moving the remainder of the current semester to remote instruction, there were some lessons that you learned that are helping inform you as you prepare for the next quarter to go to online only. What were some of those lessons learned that other institutions may want to benefit from as they prepare to lead into remote instruction?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm going to start with talking about where we were in terms of just hardware. Not all of our faculty had the hardware, meaning the computer devices, that would support virtual learning. Most did, but depending on where our faculty were in the cycle of replacing their computers, some had laptops or computers with built-in cameras and built-in microphones. Some did not, so we quickly had to assess that, to inventory that, and obtain a whole set of microphones and cameras headsets in some cases, so that all of our faculty could be prepared on the hardware side. In terms of our students on the hardware side, we did have a program through our library that would loan laptops to students, and we made an intentional decision to scale up the numbers of laptops we would have in our loaner pool, just as we were scaled up the hardware for our faculty. We had to do that very quickly. Like, that was like a 24-hour turnover, where people had to scramble. Wow. To obtain the equipment we needed and just go to a whole range of retail outlets to try to find this. On the software side, we also learned some lessons that we found were really important. So we were an institution that uses Canvas as our learning management system, and we were pleased with Canvas, but we did not have a uniform solution for video connectivity. We had a number of individual Zoom licenses that some faculty and some staff had acquired. We actually were maxed out, and so we quickly moved the institution to an institutional Zoom license with the ability to have all of our faculty and staff and students be able to access Zoom. So we went to Zoom Pro. Yes, there were some costs in that. The biggest thing there, of course, was the training. For faculty that had used Zoom or Skype previously, it wasn't a big leap. But for many of our faculty, this was brand new for them. And of course, moving from Zoom to Zoom Pro had enhanced features, and that was a training module. So we had to quickly develop a series of podcasts and documents that would walk our faculty through how to do this, as well as ramp up the one-on-one support and help that we were able to give to faculty who just were having a tough time managing this. And we needed a range of options, we learned, for our faculty. For some, they could look at an online podcast or a video, walk through it, figure it out, and make the connections. For some, they could read a step-by-step document and figure it out. For some, they either needed a person to be on the phone with them or come to their office or meet them at another place and walk them through a step-by-step how to do things, or even help set them up and model and demonstrate it. So we just had such a range of users, and we found we had to be flexible to that range of users. The other thing that we quickly ramped up, we realized that while we were trying to manage this centrally, but we also needed a hybrid approach. So we quickly identified two or three faculty that we already knew were expert users of the technology and teaching in a virtual format, and deputized them, asked them if they would be willing to be identified as leads in their school and college, as support people that their colleagues could go to, in addition to our centralized Center for Digital Learning and Innovation and our centralized IT, which has also stepped up quite a bit to help support things. Those solutions all taken together is helping us move, I think, quite quickly. In terms of some of the other challenges that we've had with specific areas, for example, labs in the sciences, we are looking for solutions where we could have virtual labs, and we were very much drawn to learning from the California State University system that even prior to this had implemented a program in their undergraduate courses where having virtual labs in the STEM area and using that via distance learning and virtual learning was already implemented. So we were able to connect there and learn some of the resources that were available. It certainly, I want to say, lends itself more in some disciplines than others. For example, a virtual lab in physics might be more straightforward than one in chemistry. And so it's an opportunity for creativity and for looking at open access resources that professors can utilize. So it's pushed everyone to think in a different way, but there are some very good resources out there.
I know we mentioned earlier in the conversation that there was some pressure from students on campus to move to remote instruction. We've also seen on many other campuses backlash from students from institutions have moved in this direction out of concerns for equity, either access to technology, to ensuring that they have reliable access to broadband internet and reliable ways of connecting to these classes, but also out of concerns that if the institution begins to close, they might lose access to their reliable sources of housing, food, and other basic needs. How has that played out on your campus? How are you taking equity into account when you think about your institution's response to this crisis?
So those are really important questions, and they're all interrelated. We have found that you can't talk about the curriculum and the decisions you're going to make there apart from the issues of equity and access to technology, apart from the housing and meal plans and what we do there, that you've got to look at all of this holistically for the benefit of the students. As we all know, there's been some real pushback in the media and on social media of institutions that moved quickly to close their residence halls to give a date by which students needed to be out, and basically to shut down those halls, to have people empty their rooms, clear out, and return the keys. And some of the pushback against some institutions has been that the message students are feeling is that, you know, we have a relationship with our college or university in a time of crisis, they're not caring for us. And so we wanted to be very thoughtful about how we would address all of those things together and what kind of messaging we would give to our students. So first of all, in terms of the access and equity to technology, we made a decision that campus is not closed. It remains open. However, we are running many areas on reduced crews of staff. And so there are what sometimes is referred to as skeleton crews, and people are rotating days so that not everyone is in every day. That seems to be working for us because many of our staff, not all by any means, and certainly not our essential staff, but many staff are able to successfully work remotely from home. But we wanted a presence on campus as well as in the offices. We did not want a situation where it appeared for all practical purposes like we were closed, and that students and parents would be trying to reach out to offices and not get any help or any response. We did not want that. So we've had our different units develop staffing plans that takes all of those kinds of things into account. So in terms of the hardware, I already mentioned that we scaled up with the loaner laptops and equipment that we would have available for students to check out through our library. We also made an intentional decision to keep the library open. And while it's not fully staffed, it is staffed. And so there is support for students, particularly students that have remained on campus in the residence halls thus far. And for many, the access to technology in the library and our computer labs that we have in the library is important. And it is the way that they're going to be able to access technology for many of them at this point. And so we have been able to do that somewhat successfully. The biggest challenge, or one of the biggest challenges, I would say, that we've been facing is the decision on the residence halls. As I referenced, some institutions came out pretty quickly and made the decision, you know, to close, and they wanted students out by a certain date. We did not take that position. We let students reflect and make decisions on what was best in their individual circumstance. After we made the announcement that the last 2 weeks of our winter quarter was going to be handled remotely, about 50% of our students in the residence halls left and went home. Yeah. Now that we're about to make the announcement that the entire spring quarter will be done remotely, we believe that will go down significantly. So what we want to do is send out a message that we strongly encourage our students to go home, because we think in most cases that's going to be the best place to ensure their safety and their health. And our residence hall staff will then inventory our students and work with them somewhat on an individual case-by-case basis to figure out if there is a reasonable exception for them to remain on campus and in the residence halls. We have some international students who literally cannot go home because they're in regions that they can't fly to. We have students in other parts of the United States who don't have a place to go that would be safe or reasonable for them. We have some students who have jobs in the community that they rely on for their livelihood and for their income, and if we in a sense dismiss them from the residence halls, they literally would have no place to go and keep mm-hmm. and be able to keep their job. Now it's an emerging situation. Some of those businesses are moving to different models of working remotely. Some of them may actually be shut down. You know, here in the Seattle area, the governor has put out some executive orders that's curtailing a number of social and athletic and other events. There's a high likelihood that we'll see further directives from the mayor or the governor that may even curtail things. So we were trying to take the stance on the residence halls that we believe strongly that for the vast majority of our students, the safest place for their health and well-being is going to be to go home. But we try to work individually with those that would need exceptions, rather than to put out a blanket statement that we thought could really cause a pushback in the overall relationship with the university and our students.
Absolutely, that makes sense. Let me ask, we focused on the conversation thus far mostly on your decision to institute remote instruction, but that's not the only hard decision that you've had to make over the last couple of weeks, ranging from things or conversations regarding restricting travel, canceling study abroad, canceling other major events on campus. What policy decision has been the hardest for your team to make, and why?
So we've had to deal with all of those issues. I'll sort of take them in reverse order. The first set of decisions had to do with whether we canceled major events that are either on campus or in the community, but related, you know, university-sponsored events. And it quickly became clear that we needed to do that. And so we made those decisions. And once we did, I think everyone understood and backed those. And that's consistent with what's happening in the community. But perhaps the hardest decisions had to do with study abroad, our spring break immersion programs that we have for students, and whether or not to have a suspension or a ban on international and domestic travel. And so we, initially thought in terms of study abroad and immersion programs that we could only look at the countries that have been highly affected by COVID-19 and that the State Department had issued a level three or level four warning. But then that changed itself. And of course, the State Department issued a global level three. So we made the decision to cancel all of our education abroad experiences that are related to the university. And that disappointed a good number of students and faculty who have been planning for these trips, which we all value and recognize their importance as learning experiences. Some of the pushback we got there had to do with trips that were planned for parts of the world that thus far have not seen a large outbreak of COVID-19. Our belief, and this was in part informed by the guidance from the State Department and CDC, was that it's only a matter of time where the situation will escalate dramatically, even in regions that thus far have not had high numbers of incidents of COVID-19. And unfortunately, that is playing out as accurate and true. So that was tough. And then on the travel ban, something similar. At first, we thought we could restrict travel to just certain parts of the world. We landed on a decision to suspend or ban all international travel through the end of the academic year and all non-essential domestic travel to the end of the academic year. Of course, that brought up a whole series of questions and concerns about travel that had already been pre-purchased or pre-arranged such that there were cancellation fees incurred, etc. So we've had to put out some guidance on that. I mean, the question was, is the university going to reimburse us for all of this travel that we now have to cancel? So what we've tried to do there is put out the guidance that first and foremost, we want our faculty and students to work through the various travel providers and vendors to see if they can have that travel canceled and either refunded or receive a credit. We know the major airlines are working with people. Hotels are now doing that. Rental cars are now doing that. So we see that there is, you know, a pathway. In many cases, the individual has to call, not simply cancel online, but to call and talk about the situation and ask for a refund or ask for a credit to be applied. And then that's forthcoming. In the cases where people make a great good faith effort to do that and are not successful, we are dealing with those on a case-by-case basis to see how we can help our faculty and our students. We don't want our faculty and students to incur out-of-pocket expenses because of the situation related to university travel.
In this conversation, we've focused a lot on the day-to-day, the short-term impacts and decisions that you and your team have had to make. Unfortunately, we also have to think about the long-term impacts of the coronavirus on our communities and questions around next year's enrollment, financial situations, research goals are all at the forefront of a lot of leaders' minds. As you think, if you can, beyond the next week, next month, to a world post the coronavirus, what concerns you the most or what steps are you taking to try to address the new reality that we will enter into?
So you raise a number of really important considerations that are top of mind for us, including the revenue loss of the rest of this academic year, not having our residence halls full, having to reimburse things that we had not planned on, a whole range of expenses either that will be incurred or revenue that will not be realized because of the situation. We're very concerned about both retention and recruitment of our students. We were concerned about sending students home, and they may just not want to come back to Seattle. And so student engagement, ongoing engagement through social media and other virtual means is critical for us. And we have a whole team working on that with our current students in terms of retention. Of course, a big part of that is if our students are receiving high quality instruction in a virtual learning environment, and they find themselves highly engaged in their education, even in this environment, then they will continue with us. And so that's one of the ways that we absolutely ensure continuity. We're very concerned about the future. You know, Seattle U is a type of institution that holds a number of in-person recruitment sessions, both the campus tours, and we believe we have the kind of campus that once people see it, they fall in love with it. And we have such a high yield rate for students and their families that come to campus and see who we are and interact with us. And we've canceled all of those tours, as most institutions of higher ed have done. We also have traditionally had large gatherings of our interested or committed students at this time in the spring quarter, bring them on campus so they can meet our faculty, learn more about us, learn more about the institution, and they can see themselves here. And we've canceled all of those. So we are working on ways to move those into a virtual environment. It's going to mean a lot more customization, individualization, and working with students and families one-on-one and personalizing our messages and our outreach. We had a meeting yesterday with a whole team that is going to be working on this. We believe we have something very special and unique to offer students by coming to Seattle U, and we're thinking of, in this environment, what are the ways to get that message out so that families understand that. We're also somewhat concerned in Seattle with, again, the way this has emerged, as Seattle is one of the epicenters of COVID-19. We're concerned with just where this might go, and that's the unknown. You know, it could be that the situation diminishes in the next month to 2 months or so, and life begins to go back to normal. It could be that this continues into the summer months, which would be much, much more difficult. I mean, we're planning for different contingencies and scenarios, including what if we had to continue virtual and distance learning and work through the summer? What if we had to do this into the fall quarter? You know, what would those kinds of things look like? Of course, we're not alone. All of higher ed is in this situation, but we're looking at a range of scenarios, including financial planning and what different scenarios would mean for us and how we would plan for it.
Last question for you. What advice do you have for other leaders at their institutions who are in the midst of or about to go through the process of dealing with COVID-19 in their communities?
So I realize that different institutions are going to be at different places on this, depending on a number of factors, and including where the institution is situated and how the COVID-19 virus has played out and the number of cases, et cetera. But my advice would be the following. Take this seriously. If you're not already understanding the urgency and the strong, strong likelihood that what's happening in regions like New York and Seattle, and what's happening in places globally like in Northern Italy and other parts of the world, there's a high likelihood that that type of a situation is coming to most communities, particularly urban areas, that large urban areas that have a lot of people who travel and a lot of people who, you know, could be in different situations. So that's the first thing, is that this is very real and we all need to take it quite seriously. A couple other points that I'm reflecting on. The other would be for leaders in our urgency, when we do realize the urgent situation and we move to act decisively, let's not also forget the humanity part of this, and the care for our students is critical. And so keeping that in mind as well is very important. We have found that multiple means of ongoing communication is critical. And the framing of what we're communicating, the importance of communicating our care and concern for our students, our faculty and staff, is critically important. Often we focus on students, we focus on faculty. What we learned here is don't forget about the staff, because they are an important part of the infrastructure of any institution of higher ed. And we often, there's a tendency at times to take our staff for granted, that they'll just soldier on in these times. And we have to be very thoughtful about what we're doing for our staff in terms of allowing them to work in different situations. In our case, we had a range of staff who themselves had compromised immune systems or other health-related issues that made this more serious for them, or for those who were 60 or over. In some cases, staff perfectly healthy, but because the local public schools closed, they now have children at home with no daycare options. And so being sensitive on a range of reasonable options for working remotely, working from home, but that still allows the institution to be open and do its business, and how you manage that with staff, we learned was really, really important. I think it's also important at a time of this for leaders to think about what life looks like beyond this current crisis, so that we can engender some hope, you know. I guess the final thought would be, if there's any silver lining in all of this, if somebody had asked me 3 weeks ago, what's the likelihood of having your entire faculty move to a virtual learning environment, I would say next to none. It's not going to happen. And yet now we've done that. And so while our faculty appropriately are going to have various responses and ranges to what it's like for them to teach virtually, they've had this shared experience that will fundamentally change their relationship to teaching and learning, and will fundamentally change higher ed in this country going forward. The conversations about virtual and online learning now will be informed by people's experience rather than just assumptions. And I think if there's any silver lining in that, it's the way that higher education is stepping up to respond and to be flexible, innovative, and accommodate. And it shows that we're able to do this in ways that probably many, many people thought higher ed wasn't capable of. And I think that's a very positive silver lining.
I've been speaking with Dr. Shane Martin, Provost at Seattle University. Dr. Martin, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure, and I send my very best to all our colleagues in higher ed as you navigate these difficult days. Thank you very much.